the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 245 for Monday, February 22nd, 2010.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I am Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire. On the other end from Fairfield, Connecticut is...
me. John F. Braun.
It's afternoon here yet again. We seem to have settled into a Monday afternoon thing temporarily, which works. Seems to work okay. I'm getting used to the light shining in. I'm not used to the cold. I forgot to turn the heat on up here in the studio, John. So it's a little chilly, but that's okay. I'll live. If you hear chattering, you know, it's not the audio stuttering. Yeah. It's just my teeth.
No, I had the G5 on that. That in of itself heats the room up pretty good.
Yeah, that's
seriously.
Right. Yeah. All right. So we have quite a few things to go through today. We've got a ton of questions. Sean, when I got to my desk this morning and figured, I'll take about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and go through all the questions.
Oh, you are going at it. I saw it, man, because, you know, of course you copy me.
Right.
You know, I do the pre-show and then you look at that and then you go through the things and yeah, you were going at it, man.
Hours. We have like three shows worth of material. So let's get right into it here and we'll go to, we issued what we called a geek challenge last week, John, when we had a listener, Mark, I believe, that wrote in and asked, okay, can I have a way to get to the recent items from the keyboard? Now, the presumption was, you know, a single keystroke. And we mentioned a couple of things, but we left it out there. And Finbar wrote in and said, I managed to accomplish this using a combination of an Apple script called Spark. An Apple script and an application called Spark. And there's a little, seven line Apple script. And then using Spark, he assigned the Apple script to a hotkey. So you can build an Apple script. And then with this application called Spark, you can assign that Apple script to a hotkey. Spark is at shadowlab.org. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. What we also have is a PDF of the Apple script itself, which we will put in the show notes. So you can go ahead and see what Finbar wrote. But that definitely solves the geek or rises to the geek challenge. So kudos to you, Finbar. That's fantastic. So now, John, you found yet another way.
Yes.
without any third party stuff.
I solved our own challenge, though it's not
awesome.
The best solution, but I do believe it meets the criteria in that. Can you get to this menu without using the mouse? I believe that was the
right.
The preference being, could you do it with a single keystroke?
Sure.
And this is not a single keystroke, but you know, it's in the back of my mind. It was bugging me. In both Leopard and Snow Leopard, if you look in the System Preferences keyboard, you will see a whole boatload of shortcuts. And there is one shortcut, Control F2. What does that do, you may ask?
What does it do, John?
Well, it's called Focus to Menu Bar. And basically what happens if you hit it, and you can even do it now, it's not going to, you know, hurt anything. The Apple menu gets highlighted. And then from that point, you can use your arrow keys and handily navigate over to the recent items. Though it may take you several key presses, but it accomplishes this without having to use the mouse.
Yeah, but that's handy to know because you're right. It does solve Mark's question, which was our challenge. But it also is a way. Let's say you have to restart your Mac, and maybe you have a keyboard that doesn't have the magic button on it that brings up the restart thing and your mouse isn't working for whatever reason, that would suffice, right? Because you could get to the Apple menu and navigate there and away you go.
Exactly. Because so I would say that, you know, if you look at Windows, I think Windows has always had better keyboard support, and that pretty much every option, I think, on most Windows applications can be accessed through the keyboard, through
right.
an Alt or other key. Mac, not as much. But using this, you can access anything, whether or not there's an explicitly defined keyboard shortcut.
That's right. Yeah, very cool.
All right.
You know what? Let's talk about our first sponsor here, and that is Circus Pony's Notebook version 3. Notebook is a place to organize all of the things organized associated with a particular project or subject on your Mac. You might have some text that you want to write down. You might have some PDF files. You might have some images. You can pull all of these into Notebook, and you can make multiple notebooks with it. Like things like, you know, let's say you've got, you know, your recipes notebook, and maybe you've got your kids, you know, plans notebook, or maybe a gift list notebook, and you can pull things in like your gift list notebook. You could say, okay, you could build a little hierarchical thing, and you could say, okay, for my wife, I want to get, you know, she doesn't like flowers or anything. She wants like gadgets. So I could put, you know, New Harmony remote or this, that, and the other thing. And then I could pull in links and PDFs for all that. And then maybe on John's list, John, you do like flowers. No, you know, I could pull in, you know, maybe a new photo paper or things like that. Right. And then pull in links to that and build it all together. And that way it's all right there. I've got a picture. I've got links. I've got the person's name, and I can reorganize. And if I remember, oh, yeah, you know, I put something in there, but I can't remember what it was. But I know that I put it in 3 weeks ago. Well, you can use their multi-deck search that will search through the notebook based on the criteria you want. And that criteria could be, in this instance, the date that you entered it. So Notebook is available from Circus Ponies. It's circusponies.com, and it is $49.95. But before you spend your money, go and download it. They have a 30-day free trial. Convince yourself that it's for you. I know you will. And then $49.95 heads off to Circus Ponies, and you get your license, and you just keep on using it just like you have. So all available. It all starts at circusponies.com. And with that, John, I think we move to Johnny, right? Okay. Johnny writes, I've run into a problem that I've not been able to solve. I'm trying to view my statements at Dish Network. When I click on the link to open the PDF of my statement, it links to a file that on my desktop gets, or in my downloads folder, gets named statement.do. I believe that this is the result of a Java applet that must open or download the actual PDF. I get the usual save or open dialog with the .do file, but I'm not sure how to proceed. I check Java on my machine with Sun Online Tool, and it reports that Java is installed and functioning on my Mac. I'm running Firefox 3.5.8. I tried Safari with the same result. What do you do with the .do file to get to the PDF? All right, John, go ahead.
Yeah, well, he's right. So a .do file, I'm looking around here, and it is a Java thing. I guess technically a Java servlet, but it is a little Java program. And, you know, I don't know if there's any way to get around this, because what's happening is that at the point in time that he's trying to grab it, it's running this a script or a Java program or a servlet with that name. And the browser isn't smart enough, or the browser is saying, oh, well, you know, I'm looking at this tag, and then this is what it's called. Right? Now, what you could do, I think one way to possibly get around this, I don't know if it's going to work, but if you do, you know, save link as instead of just, you know, save. If you just do a plain save, then it is going to get saved with that name. If you try to do a save as, perhaps you can type in a different name, though I don't know if it's going to honor it. I think it's going to overwrite it, and it is going to call it whatever .do.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that will do it. But you're right, sometimes you don't have the option. I think in Firefox, you're given more of an option. The screen he describes lets him do exactly what you just described. In Safari, I think it won't stop. I think it will just save it out. And in that sense, yeah, you just go into the Finder, rename it. When you rename it from .do to .pdf, the macOS 10 will say, hey, wait, you're changing the extension of this file name. Are you sure you want to do that? And it's at that point that you have to say, yeah, change it to PDF. That's the non-default option. The default will be to keep as .do, change it to PDF, and then it should, in theory, open up just fine. Right? Anything else to add there, John, before we try the next thing here?
Nope.
All right. We'll go to David's audio question.
Hi, guys. This is David from Boise, Idaho. I've been listening to the show for a little while, a little over a year now, and really appreciate all the help that you've given to all of us. My question is about syncing iCal with Gmail calendar. And I've even looked through the communities on Apple.com, and it seems that a lot of people are having an issue where we can all get the calendars to download into iCal just fine. But it's the reverse that we have an issue with. specifically me, been able to get the Gmail calendar come in just fine. No issues there. And I'm able to get the delegations to come down as well. But I'm having an issue with getting my calendar published or synced up to the Gmail calendar. Just can't seem to be able to get that to work. And I'd really appreciate some help there. This is where you cut me off.
All right. You got it. Yeah. So this is my realm here. I'll take this one. iCal sucks. That's like become my mantra. I say that to get to sleep at night because it's just such a comfortable thing to say. Mm-hmm. But in this regard, there is something better. You have two options from Busy Mac Software. There are two pieces of software that will help. One is called Busy Sync, and Busy Sync is built to work with iCal. But it will sync iCal with Google Calendar. It'll also sync across your LAN, but it will sync with Google Calendar in a much more robust way than iCal currently does. So that would be the first step. If you want to continue using iCal, go ahead and get Busy Sync and do that. However, one step up, as I think Busy Sync is $39, for $49, you can get Busy Cal, which is a complete replacement for iCal. It will pull in all of your iCal data automatically because they both talk to the calendar store using sync services. And it has Busy Sync built into it. So it will do all the Google syncing right there from within Busy Cal. You can configure it right there. You don't have to deal with a separate preference pane or an app or anything. And it's much, much smoother. So I highly recommend checking out one of those two options. Otherwise, yeah, you're going to continue to run into kind of these brick walls of iCal as you try it that way. So anything to add, John, before we move on to George?
I got to say iCal, you know, with the syncing and all that serves my needs, but my needs are modest.
There you go.
Yeah. You're a more demanding user, especially when you talk about tasks and other things like that. But I just use it just to basically just have appointments and have, you know, get alerts when they're coming up.
Sure. Sure. All right. Going on to George, we have, it seems to happen all the time. And maybe it's just because of the sheer volume of questions and comments we get. But we've got a couple of related things in here. And George, we'll let George start it off. He says, I'm relatively new to the Mac in that I have never done a fresh install of the OS. I'm thinking about upgrading my 24-inch iMac to a new 27-inch iMac. So here is my question. Sorry, folks. You know, John, I did that upgrade to Snow Leopard to stop.
Oh, the free advice I gave you.
Yeah, yeah. It was worth every penny.
Which would be zero.
Yeah, in fact, it was, you know, there's a definition of worthless. And if you break that word apart, worthless, right? So it was worth less than the time it took to explain it because it's actually costing me more time. In addition to having just upgraded to Snow Leopard and not made any progress in terms of getting this stuttering problem to go away or this audio glitch issue to go away, it's actually made it worse. We've now had three interruptions in this show alone, and that doesn't count the two false starts that we had because of the same issue. So yes, this is
all right.
A train teetering on the tracks. We will move on. George says his question is, what is the best way to prepare my iMac for sale? I obviously don't wish to expose my data. I was thinking I would do a super duper disk clone of the old machine for backup before carrying out the migration assistant data transfer, then somehow erase the whole disk on the old machine and then reinstall from my Snow Leopard installed disk. Is this the best course of action? Along those lines, if I were to send my machine into Apple for repair at some stage, how would I ensure my data remains secure? Would it be best to make a disk copy and erase it before sending it in? So we're going to answer the first question, and we actually have an audio comment that answers the second question in the form of a tip. So, John, why don't you start with the first one, and then we'll kind of bounce it back and forth from there.
Mm. Oh, Migration Assistant, that aspect of it?
Yeah. His first part. Yeah.
Well, no, to me, that's a recent addition once they, added a Time Machine. But that's exactly what Migration Assistant is supposed to do. If you have a Time Machine backup and you want to bring all your data over to a new machine, that the Yeah, I have no problem with that. That's exactly what you should do.
Okay. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, the migration assistant is the magic there. But then let's talk about preparing it for sale. The next stage of this, John. So he's done the migration assistant. He's also done a super duper disk clone. So he's got a backup of this disk somewhere. So so now he's got his new Mac, his 27-inch iMac up and running based on his migration assistant. He's also got this super duper clone safekeeping somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Now it's time for him to get this machine ready for sale. And he says he wants to somehow erase the disk and then reinstall Snow Leopard. What do you think about that?
I would disagree with that. That is not the course of action I would follow, because I've done this in the past where I've sold my trusty PowerBook G4 12-inch. There are a number of issues. So number one, what I would do is install, because he said Snow Leopard disk. He did not say the disks that the machine came with. Unless the disks that came with the machine have Snow Leopard. But just to be clear, there's a difference. So you get some disks that come with each machine that are very specific to that machine. Or pretty right. specific as far right. as they have the hardware tests and stuff like that.
And they also have all the apps that were supposed to yes. come with that machine.
Like
that's right.
iLife and things like that, which that does not come with the OS upgrade or the OS install. So the downside is that you may be giving it to someone and it does not have the latest operating system, depending on when you bought the machine, but it will be in pristine condition as if it was new, except it's not, but it'll come as it did in the box, at least from a system configuration point of view, what software is on there. The other thing is kind of a little, so that's what I would do, and kind okay. of a little tangent here. I yeah. would also, now I've seen this, and I'm not saying that this is what's going to happen, but I've seen this also, and I guess just the caution is when you prepare a machine for sale. Now I've seen people do this, and I think this is very questionable legally, is that they'll be like, yeah, I got the PowerBook, whatever, or the MacBook, whatever, and here's all these apps on here, and here you go. And I'm not only going to charge you for the machine, I'm not going to charge you the thousands of dollars for the apps here. I would be very careful about buying a machine where the person claims to be, unless they give you all the media and all the licenses for all the apps, and don't just give you the machine with all the stuff already installed on there. Because that gets to be risky. One, it's legally questionable. And number two, if any of the software is still being used by the seller, which it may be.
Right.
I'm not going to say everybody who does this is being dishonest. But if they are, then you may end up buying a machine where if they have particular sort of DRM, like activation keys, or they phone home or something like that, which is why you should use your friend Little Snitch. Then you may get software that's going to die, or you may get yelled at, or the software cops may come to your door. I doubt the software cops will come, but
right.
Don't. So again, just a piece of advice: don't be, don't buy a machine with the promise of all this free software on it that you're not being charged for, because it could get you in trouble. So
yeah, that's a good point. And I'm not sure what came with George's 24-inch iMac. If it was Snow Leopard, then, of course, putting the original discs on would get you Snow Leopard and you're good to go. But it's also possible that it came with Leopard 10.5. In this case, he's going to get Snow Leopard discs with his new machine. So what he could do is install, wipe the drive clean and then install the original discs on there, which let's say they'll get the machine up to 10.5, then install Snow Leopard if the person purchasing it wants that done ahead of time, and include the disc in with the bundle, because if you don't need it anymore, then you include it in and you've kind of done the guy a solid. You get him up and running on Snow Leopard, make sure the machine works for him, and send it off. But I don't like to engage in the legally questionable practice of installing a ton of software on a machine and then selling it. That's it just opens the door a little too far for my comfort level.
Now, the other thing you could do, one additional piece of advice is, if you just reinstall the OS from the disk that came with the machine.
Yeah.
There's a slight chance, if you're dealing with someone on the other end who's skilled, that may not necessarily erase all of the data thoroughly.
That's right.
So one thing you may want to consider, and it depends on how insane you want to be, but Disk Utility has a number of format options. And I think they have one, at the very least, I think they have one that'll, you know, that will also overwrite free space.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Oh, they'll do it. Yeah, it'll do a one pass or a, like a 36 pass, I think, if you do it that way. I'm hesitant to open Disk Utility on this machine because it, you know, it'll make all the stuttering happen. But yes, it is possible to do an erase disk in Disk Utility and really securely wipe out the disk by overwriting the data that was out there with one random ones and zeros.
Yeah. So the option here, so I'm looking at it right now and I'm going to take the, you know, the bullet for you, Dave, here and do this just because I can.
Because you can.
And we don't want your, the system's already kind of teetering here. But anyway, so it's in Disk Utility, you highlight the drive and then there's going to be an option, erase free space, ... You click on that and you have three options, zero out deleted files. And that's the quickest, maybe not the, and it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Then there's a seven pass. If you're really worried, though, warning, it's going to take seven times the amount of time. And then if you're totally insane or you have like national security secrets on your machine, you may want to do the 35 pass erase. But you know, this could take days.
Oh yeah, yeah,
or
quite
weeks.
Reasonably. Yeah.
If you have, you know, a terabyte drive or something like that. So yeah. But yeah, consider those options, because again, if somebody is determined or skilled, they may be able to retrieve your old data, and you probably don't want that to happen.
So. Probably not. Yeah. All right. So to answer the second part of the question, we'll play a tip that actually came in a couple of weeks ago from John, not you, John, of course, but listener John.
Hi, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. Recently, I had to send my MacBook Pro into AppleCare for service. Not wanting to give Apple all my personal data, I copied my home folder to an external drive and then went to System Preferences, Accounts, clicked on my user account, and selected Advanced Options. Under Advanced Options, I changed the location of my home folder to the copy located on the external drive. I verified that this worked by rebooting the machine. Everything worked fine. I then deleted my user folder on the MacBook's hard drive and used Disk Utility to erase free space. I created a dummy admin account for AppleCare to use while they were fixing my computer, and I did not delete my user account. When I picked up my laptop, I was informed that the logic board had been replaced. When I got home, I logged into my regular account with the external drive containing my home folder attached to the computer. As expected, the computer booted up fine and I had access to all of my files. I then reversed the original process by copying my user folder from the external hard drive back into the user's folder on the laptop's internal hard drive. I then went back into System Preferences, Accounts, clicked on my username, selected Advanced Options, and changed the home folder of my user account to the newly copied home folder now located on the internal drive. After restarting the computer, I could not access any of my files. My user account did not have the permission to access the subfolders of my home folder. I selected my user folder, clicked on Get Info, and then added my user account, giving myself read and write access to the home folder. I then clicked on the sprocket at the bottom of the Get Info window and selected Apply to Enclosed Items. I logged out and logged back in, and all was fine. Everything seems to be working okay. However, I just don't know if this was the right way to do this. My question is, have I done something to my data that may come back and bite me later on? Additionally, the next time I need to do this, what is the proper way to move and then move back a user folder? Thanks for your help. Love the show. Here's where you cut me off.
I think that's awesome, John. And I'll offer my initial gut answer to that question, which is I think that's absolutely the best, most secure, and yet least impactful way to do this. Yes, it requires spending the time to copy the data back and forth, but you're not deleting your user account. You're not losing all your preferences. You're not losing anything other than a little bit of time copying the data. And that time is your investment in security there. I think that's a great way to do this. What do you think, John?
I think he touched, you know, we talked about some of it before, but I think the methodology is sound. And I think every step that he described makes sense. As you pointed out, it'll take time, but I'm with him on that. Yeah, because you never know when you send it away for repair where it's going to go, right?
That's right. And, you know, so there's two things to be worried about when you send it in for repair. The thing that John's address, well, John's actually addresses both of them. His initial goal was to address, well, I want my data to stay secure. And that's great. You know, he doesn't want to share his data with the Apple technicians that are out there. Can't really blame him for that. Although, you know, chances are they don't have time to start going through your stuff anyway. But always better safe than sorry. The second thing to worry about is that when they're going through your machine, typically when you send it to Apple, they take a look at everything because it costs them money to get your machine from you to them and back to you. And in addition to that, you know, they're also working very hard to ensure, you know, the best customer experience possible. So the last thing they want is for you to have to send it back in 3 weeks later because of some other issue. Along those lines, they tend to test the machine for anything else that might be going on. They don't guarantee that they do this, but it's part of their standard practice. I've sent machines in and said, oh, yeah, you know, there's something wrong with the display. And it comes back and they're like, yeah, we fixed the display. We replaced the logic board, the keyboard and the hard drive. It's like, oh, OK, you know, that can be a surprise to you. Always assume that the hard drive will be replaced. So John's method also protects him against, you know, replacement of that drive in that he keeps all his data. Obviously, a super duper clone or a carbon copy cloner clone of the drive would allow him to, you know, restore much more quickly. But at least in this case, he's got a backup of his data.
Now, I don't think they offer it anymore. I think they used to offer a data backup service.
I don't think they offer that anymore, but you're right. They used to at one point.
For a fee, they would guarantee that they would back up your data and restore it to.
If you don't go to Apple directly, if you go to an Apple authorized service provider, they will, at their discretion, offer a data backup service still. I know the local one to me here, MacEdge, I've seen it on the form. You know, do you want us to back up your data? Check here. And there's a cost associated, you know, it's non-trivial. I mean, it's, you know, $50 or $100 or something to do that. But, if you don't have any way of doing that, or if you simply want it handled by somebody else, then they're happy to do it. All right. Along these lines, we have a question from Jeremy that's timely.
Hi, it's Jeremy from the UK here. I have a question regarding backing up from a Time Machine backup to a different Mac. My MacBook Pro 17-inch has had to go back to Apple to have its NVIDIA card swapped out, a known issue apparently that you guys may know about, that incidentally rendered it completely useless as it couldn't be woken from sleep by any means, taking the battery out, resetting the PMS, leaving it to run flat, running it without the battery and the power cord in. It just, every time you restarted it, it wouldn't restart, it just went straight back into sleep mode because it hadn't actually ever come out of it. Anyway, I've had to, I have Time Machine backups. My question is there any way of restoring the data to a new machine, in this case, an iMac? I've got as far as connecting the drive with the Time Machine backups to the iMac, where, of course, it asks me if I want this drive to be the Time Machine backup. And I'm worried that if I say yes, then the next stage would be to overwrite my MacBook Pro backups with the iMac data rather than give me the option that I'm looking for, which is to restore the Time Machine backup from my rather poorly MacBook Pro to this iMac, which is only a temporary measure anyway, but it would just be simpler. At the moment, I've just been dragging files backwards and forwards, but it would just be much simpler if I could use the Time Machine backup. Any ideas, chaps? And this, as they say, is where you cut me off.
You folks are getting creative here. I like this. It's good. So, John, why don't you take this? Go ahead.
Oh, I think you should take it.
All right, then I'll take it. We're talking about restoring from a Time Machine backup, and definitely this is totally doable. Plugging that, this is how it works. When you back up, it creates a folder on your drive that you're going to back up to, and it tags that folder with the MAC address of your machine. So if you plug it into another machine or even essentially the same machine that's had a motherboard replaced, it's going to create a new folder and it's not going to overwrite the machine. So if you take this and plug it into the iMac and you say, look, I just want to restore from the Time Machine backup, boom, that's how it'll work. I think it's going to work just fine. Am I missing something here, John, or are you with me on this?
I'm with you. Okay. No, I see what you have here. Yes. Because the backup is tied to a specific machine.
Right.
Shouldn't be any worries.
That's right. That's right. And you know, Migration Assistant will actually, as we talked about with the previous caller, Migration Assistant will pull this data in. You can run Migration Assistant either, you know, the first time your machine starts up, or you can go to, I believe it's Applications Utilities, is where the Migration Assistant lives, and you can run that manually at any time, and tell it, yeah, go ahead and get this data, you know, pull this data from this, other Time Machine backup. The other way you can do it is, you can, if you go up to your Time Machine menu at the top of the screen and you have another disk either attached or on the network, instead of saying enter Time Machine, which will enter Time Machine for that computer's backups, if you hold down the option key, you can go to browse other Time Machine disks, and that will allow you to look at the backups of other computers that are on that drive.
That
learn something new every day, huh?
Neat.
See, that's it. That's the price of admission there, folks. Or that's worth the price of admission there. So,
you know, here's another one very quick that I ran across.
Yeah.
I saw on Twitter. It's kind of related to the keyboard stuff and little shortcuts that I never noticed before.
Yep.
I was actually in iPhoto the other day, and I was, because I'm, you know, I like taking pictures and sharing, and I like to, now unfortunately the camera will give it a name that's, you know, usually P, whatever sure. The convention is for that camera.
Sure.
So what I do is I'll highlight the name that it gives it, and then I'll type in a caption that I think is useful. And I accidentally the other day hit escape. And lo and behold, it gave me a whole bunch of words that matched the first few letters that I had typed in. I'm like, huh?
Really?
And then I tried this, but then it seems to work in other places. So I tried this in stickies and the same sort of thing. I typed, you know, first few letters here. I'm going to even try it now.
Really?
I'm doing it right now in text edit. So I just typed in the word H-E-L because I'm thinking of typing hello. I hit escape. And I see held, Helen, Helens, Helena.
Question.
I never knew hitting escape. Go ahead.
Do you have iTunes open? Can you open up iTunes? And I want you to try this there, because I'm curious if this is available only in Cocoa apps or if it's available in Carbon apps. And iTunes, as we know, is still a Carbon app. Whereas the rest of the apps that you mentioned, I believe, are all Cocoa apps. I'm pretty sure iPhoto is Cocoa and has been for a while. So as I was vamping there, hopefully iTunes is now open on your machine, John, and you're testing this out live.
Yes. Hold on.
Okay. He's leaning away to the other machine, folks. You can hear him. He's stretching. He's getting ready.
I got to find a place in iTunes where I can enter information. I tried the info for a song.
Yeah.
I hit escape and it dismissed the window.
Ah, right.
Now that could be because it dismisses the window. So
yeah. So what if you highlight a song name, just in the browser view? This is probably the wrong app to test this, only because it's not the app where you would probably do these sorts of things. But it allows us to test that Carbon versus Cocoa thing. Anything, John? All right, you know what I'm going to do?
No, we'll try it later.
I'm going to let you test it while I tell them about the next sponsor. But go ahead, finish your thought.
No, I don't have. I'm going to try to find a place on iTunes where I can do this.
Okay.
Report back to you.
All right, awesome. So our second sponsor is GoTo Assist Express from Citrix. Any of you who have tried to help someone solve a technical problem over the phone will appreciate the value in something like the GoTo Assist Express. And of course, the last thing you want to do, even worse than being on the phone and trying to be the brains while they're being the hands and eyes and them driving. Even worse than that is actually getting in the car and, of course, driving over there. And in some cases, of course, you know, they're thousands of miles away and that's not possible. So the folks at Citrix, these are the same people that have GoToMyPC and GoToMeeting, have GoToAssist Express. And it is a remote control system for controlling remote computers. The cool part is you create your account as the techie. You go in, you create an account on, you know, GoToAssist.com. You set all this up and then you say, I want to go help someone, and you give them a URL. You can email it to them. You could even read it to them over the phone if you had to. Once they click that URL, it brings them to a web page. They go through, they authenticate, they say, yeah, I do want to let Dave, you know, manage my computer. And then, boom, you're sitting there waiting, and then suddenly you get notification that, yep, here we go, and it brings you in. John and I have tried this. It traverses firewalls really, really well. And, of course, it gives the user whose computer is being controlled the option to end the session at any time. You can try this out. It's called GoToAssist Express. You can try it out for free by going to GoToAssist.com/gab. That's all lowercase. GoToAssist.com/GAB, all lowercase. And you can try that out. So we appreciate them sponsoring the show, and hopefully you'll appreciate checking it out. John, did you, how are we doing over there? Did you, any luck?
I don't know if iTunes is the best app to test this, because basically anything I brought up, Escape will hit the cancel button in the dialogue. And almost everything that I brought up had a cancel button. So I think, if you bring up a window that does not have a cancel button, which is, of course, the case in TextEdit or Stickies, then hitting Escape and also iPhoto, because iPhoto, you know, that dialogue there where you highlight the name of the picture and then start to type something, Escape doesn't close it.
Right.
So I think it's just a weird name. Though you bring up a good point.
I think it's only Cocoa. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And iTunes is the one holdout from their iLife suite that does not. So everything else is Coco, GarageBand,
I think so. I think they are. Yeah, I think so. I think. I don't know. What do I know? I'm just here. I'm happy to be here. All right. So let's go to David's question here. This is interesting.
Hi, guys. This is David from Boise, Idaho again. Sorry for sending two notes, but I just ran across another issue. I have my son on the computer who's 12, with parental controls applied to his account. Now, this issue again applies to Gmail, in that neither he nor any of his friends, when logged into his account, can select the sign-in option to either sign into their own Google page or sign into their own Gmail account. Safari just pops up a message saying, cannot open page. Now, I have gone in and, through the parental controls, added access to Google.com as well as the individual site address strings for Gmail and iGoogle to allow them to sign into their own accounts and sites. However, this still brings up the exact same message. And I have also gone through reset Safari. I've manually cleared out the cookies, the cache, the history, each of those different options, and still end up with the same results. Now, if I go into the parental controls and also or switch it to allow all sites in the parental controls for the internet, then all of a sudden it will allow everything to go through just fine. But obviously, this is not the ideal way for the parental controls to work right now, because I would still like to be able to filter some of the unsavory content out there. So if you have any thoughts on this, that would be great. I am using Snow Leopard, and I have downloaded the combo updates, so I know it's not an issue there. And I've also checked the communities and found that other people are having similar issues with this and also with Netflix as well. So if you could help us out again, that would be great. This would be where you cut me off.
All right. John, I don't use parental controls here, although the day may come when that's the right move. Right now, OpenDNS has been a good thing for me to manage. We haven't had any problems, but you know, it's just a peace of mind. I use OpenDNS and I tell it don't resolve any porn sites or you know.
Oh, all right. So they have a web configuration utility
exactly.
That lets you.
Yep, you set them as your DNS provider on the router, and I know this is a tangent, but that's that's what you come here for, right? With OpenDNS, you set them as you go into your router and you set them as your DNS provider. You set them as every DNS provider. On mine, I have three options for it. So they've only got two addresses. I put them in, put the first one in the first and third, and then the second one in the second. And then you can go online and you configure your account and you can do it for free, or you can pay $10 a year for your family and get even more options. But yeah, you can go in and they categorize all the domains. It's sort of a crowdsourcing thing where they have people vote on it and domains can get categorized various different ways. But you can go through and you can either block domains explicitly, whitelist domains explicitly, or go through and say, look, I don't want porn. I don't want gambling. I don't want tobacco. I mean, it gets really specific, which is cool because I don't care about gambling and tobacco and, alcohol and all that. But it's the porn stuff, I leave that out. It's fine. So,
now, can you do that to a machine level?
Mm. Well,
or is it because you get a IP address for a DNS server? Is that correct?
Correct. It looks at the IP address that your request comes from, which for me is IP address for the whole house, right? For the whole setup here.
So in your case, it's global.
It's global. Okay. If for whatever reason, you need to bypass. I mean, my wife every now and then will say to me, "Oh, I can't get to this site," because she's looking at some knitting project or something that's hosted at like DeviantArt.com, and she's like, "Oh, this is a pain." Like, okay, well, I can either go in and whitelist it, and it happens immediately. Within a minute or whatever, their servers are smart enough to pick it up.
And the next time I come up, I want to gamble up a storm. So we'll just whitelist those.
Well, we can whitelist them, or what you do is you put in, and of course, all the parents who are listening to this with their kids that use OpenDNS, sorry. But what you do is you find out the IP address of the name server, like, for us here, since we use Comcast, you find out Comcast name server address. And then you just go onto your Mac, and instead of having the router's address that's assigned, you just put in your Comcast one or whatever your local provider's one is. And then it just simply bypass that and do it. But you need admin access to the machine. So for you parents that don't want your kids to do what we just told you, don't give your kids admin access to their machines. So, what were we talking about? Anyway, back to David's question with the parental controls. Here we go. So I took a look at this, John, and it seems like Google, I looked at the source of the Gmail login page, and I found that there are two things that it might try to access when you click sign in. One is at https://mail.google.com, and the other is at https://www.google.com. I don't know which of those it is. It was hard to tell. But those are the two things that I would definitely whitelist. If that doesn't work, I believe system preferences keeps logs. And if you go into I believe parental controls keeps logs. So you go into system preferences, click on parental controls, and click on the user. And then under each user, there's a logs tab. And under that, there's a listing for website blocked. So under the logs tab, son of a gun, this thing is stuttering on me. I'm hating Snow Leopard on this machine, John.
Well, you're going to restore it.
Yeah. Okay. So under system preferences, parental controls, user, click on logs. It's doing it to me again. It's like it's taunting me. We're going to try this one more time. System preferences, parental controls, the user, logs, websites blocked. And it should show you what it did. All right. Are we here? Is this thing still going to work? You with me, John? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So that should show you what it has blocked. And in theory, you'll know what to whitelist, and it gives you a little UI to do that there. So you got anything to add to that, John?
No, I really haven't used parental control since I'm the only adult here and trust myself to make the proper judgment.
All right, well, next time we're together, I'll install parental controls on your machine for you, John.
Oh, no, you're not.
All right, let's go to where are we here time wise? It's time to do something about this machine, is what it is. What did they break in Snow Leopard? Or not Snow Leopard. It's worse than Snow Leopard. But what did they break with these Intel machines? This is great with the PowerPC Mac. All right. We will go to Michael's question. Michael writes, I run Windows 7 in boot camp so I can play Call of Duty 4 and Fallout 3. The performance is great, but the left side of the keyboard of my MacBook Pro gets very hot very quickly. Do you think this is normal? The specs that are, I have the most basic MacBook Pro that that you can get 15 inch. All right, John, we talked about this in I guess it was MacGeekab 243, which was a premium show and was also the one we did live at Macworld Expo. But we did talk about this then. And so it's worth reiterating here. But I'll let you go ahead.
I'll speculate. Now, one, I think I'm wondering if it may be a design flaw in some of the MacBook Pros. I mean, the heat has to go somewhere, and since the hard drive is pretty much on the left side of the machine there, the other thing I'm wondering about is if that hard drive is not the hard drive that originally came in the machine, that maybe it's a higher capacity or different, it may be drawing more power and therefore generating more heat.
Could be, yeah.
That's my thought. Now, there's something called temperature monitor. Now, he says he's running this in boot camp, right?
Right.
So maybe, you know, after, you know, quickly after, you know, once the machine's all cranked up there, reboot, go into Mac OS, or even, I don't know if Windows programs would have the ability to get to these temperature sensors, but there is something called temperature monitor on the Mac side, which will probe every temperature sensor in the machine. And there are usually quite a few, including one, at least in my MacBook Pro, that measures the hard drive temperature. So look at that number. Now, I think I came up when I was at the show there with like something under 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Really?
Yeah, it's 92 degrees.
Is that what your MacBook Pro is running at right now?
The hard drive temperature.
The hard drive temp. Yeah. Yeah. All right. John F. Braun, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, no, check here we out. Go. There sorry, I'm making noise here.
That's okay.
SmartDisk, Hitachi, blah, 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 93.2 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the coolest thing in the machine. Oh, look at this. Enclosure bottom side, 93.2 degrees. Huh, funny how those two match. And then everything else. And actually, the highest temperature here is between the CPU, which is up at 183.
Yeah.
And the GPU, that's about 170. But yeah, so actually the 93 is a, you know, the lowest number again on this machine here.
I think
the bottom side
on the MacBook Pros, if I'm not mistaken, I think the GPU is also on the left hand side. And I might be wrong about that, but it's possible that, you know, because you're running that the 3D stuff, that, you know, it's using the GPU a whole lot more, and that might be adding to the heat that's over there from the hard drive itself.
So, yeah.
But the answer is yes, it's normal. Lots of people report that these machines get hot. You know, it's one of the reasons that they have those cool pads that you can kind of put between your lap and the machine. It's normal. Yep. Yep.
Or stand. The worst thing is to have it flush either directly in contact with something, or like probably the worst thing, which I used to do but didn't, you know, say you want to, you know, do some surfing before you go to sleep. Well, putting it on a blanket or something like that, well, that's a nice insulator right there.
Yeah.
That's not going to help your heat flow. So try to get something to get airflow going under the machine, if at all possible.
Yep. Yep. All right. Where are we here, John? I'm all, this is good. Let's go to Robert here as soon as I can get there.
Hi, John and Dave. It's Robert Hazelrig calling you because I got a brand new iMac, and my iMac is giving me issues. Go figure. It's a refurb 24-inch that I got for 30% off, 38% off. Anyway, the issue that I'm getting is every time I open a third-party software application, it reminds me that I downloaded this from the internet, and do I want to open it anyway? Now, I've opened these applications several times, and every time I say yes, it's okay. but it asks me every single time I open any third-party application like Skype or Handbrake or CyberDuck, any of those applications, even 1Password. Just keeps opening that query up again every time. I went in and opened all the applications and tried to repair permissions, and I got this unusual message. The unusual message is, warning, SUID file system file in system library core has been modified and will not be repaired. Now, I don't know what that is or what I should do about it. I'm afraid to remove any files from the library core. But anyway, if you have any suggestions, I would appreciate it. Hope you guys had a wonderful time at Macworld, and I hope it was as fruitful as you had hoped it would be. My contact is...
All right, we'll cut you off there, Robert.
Last point first.
Yeah,
go ahead. That warning that he got.
Yeah.
There is an Apple Knowledge Base article, TS1448. The following are examples of messages that may appear in disk utility log window when repairing disk permissions. And there's a whole boatload of them. Warning, SUID file, and then I forget the one that he mentioned specifically, and they have a big old list here, has been modified and will not be repaired. And their resolution to this is you can safely ignore these messages.
Okay.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
Now,
no, you're right.
Know, it's kind of you know, disconcerting that, you know, well, I think something's wrong and I'm not going to fix it. Yeah. So, but we'll link to that article. So that's not a problem.
Right.
However, the one that he is running into, to me, that does sound like a problem, because normally that message should only come up once.
Well, and here's,
how would you fix it, Dave?
Here's the thing. The message shouldn't necessarily come up at all. The only time I've seen that message come up is when I install a new app, and before I run it for the first time,
yeah,
I launch it by opening a document. Right. So instead of clicking on the app itself and saying, you know, open this, you know, by double clicking on it or clicking on it in the dock or whatever, let's say it's Microsoft Word. Right. If I install Microsoft Word and then launch it, it's fine. But if I install Microsoft Word and then go into my documents folder and double click on a Word doc, it says, hey, wait a minute, this action that you've initiated here is going to open up Microsoft Word for the first time. Are you sure you want to do that? And you say yes, and then off you go. So it should never happen with something like Skype, where you're only doing it directly by opening Skype. Now, Skype has a different warning. It'll say, you know, you downloaded this from the internet. Are you sure you want to do it? And again, that should happen once, and that'll happen either way. So something's wrong here. And I believe all of this is stored in a database that macOS 10 calls the Launch Services database. That is, you know, part of the buried in macOS 10. And it's the thing that keeps track of all these things. I'm reminded of this because anytime I rebuild the Launch Services database, I deal once with the very messages that Robert is talking about here. So to rebuild it, there's some terminal command you can do. But listen, you know, no, you don't have to do that. Go download Onyx. It's free. And then go into maintenance, rebuild. So you're going to click on maintenance at the top, then you go to the rebuild tab, and then make sure launch services is checked. On that same screen, DYLD shared cache is fine. That's going to be checked. You can leave that. And there's two others that are going to be checked. That's going to be fine. Execute. Tell it to rebuild. It's a matter of good course. Reboot the computer once it's done. And that should hopefully, you know, hopefully what your problem, Robert, is that you've got a corrupted launch services database. But by rebuilding it, it'll force you to go through all of that one more time. And then hopefully you'll be OK. I do recommend rebuilding launch services maybe once every 6 months, because it can get tied in knots. You know, yeah. So again, Onyx will do it for you. And I think that'll solve your issue. Got anything else, John?
Nice. That's a good one. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that message is kind of annoying sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, well-intentioned, right? But it can be a pain. All right. I wanted to talk about a couple things. As I was digging out from Macworld, you know, I have my bags of tricks here. And as I was digging out, I wanted to talk about two things that I use, and I realized that they're both made by the same company called Cable Jive. obviously I travel with my iPhone. I also travel with an iPod while traveling. Sorry. And one thing that, so I do, I use on the airplane, I have, a spare battery that I like to plug in if I'm using a, you know, watching a movie or whatever, John. And I had this problem because I'm taking my cables and just shoving them into my bag and not being very, very good about them. And Cable Jive has this cable that they call the DuraSync cable. And it's got a USB port on one end, like you'd plug into your computer or this external battery. And on the other end, you plug it into the back of your iPhone. And this is like this DuraSync cable. It's made to be completely beat on and still work. You know, the big problem would be is you're twisting it up and all that stuff. Well, this thing, it's well shielded. It's got like, you know, three layers of rubber and all this other stuff on it. It's thick, but it's totally the right thing to use for this purpose. So I wanted to mention that because I'm always so thankful for it every time I pull it out, and I never think to mention it on the show that I'm doing it, because I'm always in the air when I think of it. And then the other thing that I have that I also got from Cable Jive is this thing called the iStubs, which is a really, really short cable. It's got USB on one end and the dock connector on the other. But it's like, you know, maybe 6 inches long, which is great if I want to charge my iPod on the desk in the hotel and not just have cables everywhere. So I carry both of those and I like it. And the next thing I want to get, these guys make all the cool little things, is I want to get a dock cable extender, because I've got a speaker system in the house here, the old Spectone Retro speaker system. But it's got a dock connector in it, but I don't like to take my iPod or iPhone out of its case to plug it in. So I want to get one of those extenders. So that's the next purchase from Cable Jive. So I figured I'd throw that out there because it's cool stuff. Maybe I should have saved it for cool stuff found, John.
Could have. Now you did something else here, Dave. I don't know if you want to talk about this briefly, because I have a little tangent off of it. That's something that's always concerned me.
Okay. When I was going through my machines, you know, I've got the iMac at the house. Now that machine had 2 gigs of RAM, 2 1-gig sticks. And then the Intel iMac here in the studio has, had 2 2-gig sticks. And the one in the house, we're constantly doing fast user switching. And, I know that we're always, you know, pushing up against the limits of the RAM, cause I look and iStat menus tells me that we are. So I figured, well, you know, why don't, and I'm never using, I'm not even close to using all the RAM. I'm barely using the 2 gigs on this machine here in the office, and it has 4 in the studio, and it has 4. So I figured, well, why not mix them up? And so I took, you know, 1 2-gig stick out of one 1-gig stick out of the other and swapped them. And so now I've got 3 gigs in each. The office machine's been fine RAM wise. We're still not even ever going into swap. And it has made a huge difference in the house in terms of the performance of that machine, going from 2 gigabytes to 3, even without the fast user switching being used. It's still way faster. It wakes up from sleep faster. I mean, it's clear that 2 gigs was simply not enough to do, the regular day to day tasks. I don't do anything special with that machine at all. But but 3 gigs makes a huge difference over there. So I wanted to mention that just because I've always said in the past, oh yeah, 2 gigs is enough. No, I don't believe that anymore. Three gigs makes is the difference with Snow Leopard. So
I agree with you. Yeah. The Dell that I was using had 2 gigs and it was limited.
Yeah.
To 2 gigs. You could not put any more
right
in there.
Right.
It started sucking after a while, because also I was using it for development purposes and that, you know.
Right.
Takes a lot of memory. So, and yeah, both my machines, my MacBook Pro, I have 4 gigs, and then my G5 here, I actually have 5.5 gigs.
Oh, very cool.
And that's comfortable. Now, the one thing that bugs the heck out of me, Dave, and this will be I don't know if it's a geek challenge, but just a question to our audience here is, the iMac, for whatever reason, I've gone on about this before, but there's something called dual channel support where we have in the past, I think, suggested that in general, you get a small performance boost if you have a matched pair of memory that are the same size and speed and all of that stuff. And as far as I can tell, the only Mac that does not support that, and crucially even backs you up on this, is the iMac. The Mac Pro supports it. The MacBook Pro supports it. I believe the MacBook supports it. And even the Mac Mini supports it. All of these machines advertise this support. Now, on the other hand, it gives you a marginal performance increase. I think it's on the order of 3 to 5%.
I think that's right. Yeah.
And from what I've seen, I found a study. I'll try to dig it up again. But if you have a choice between matched memory, assuming that your iMac would benefit from it, and adding more memory, clearly go for more memory. Again, it was shocking that the study I saw where it said, yeah, well, you get this little smidge of performance maybe in this one benchmark, but then all these other benchmarks having more memory, or like in Photoshop or something like that, clearly gave you a, sure. So I'm going to find that, because it's counterintuitive. I would think, well, you know, dual channel, I mean, you get, you know, I think it addresses the memory in, you know, 128-bit chunks instead of 64 or something like that.
But okay.
It sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah, it does sound good. Yeah,
but yeah,
I agree.
So I think one of the things short of getting an SSD is getting more memory if you want your Mac to run fast.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, and it's strange that the iMacs are seemingly the lone Apple machines that don't support dual channel. It doesn't make any sense to me. But because I looked that up after I did it and realized it was faster, I thought, ooh, but am I going to see a performance decrease in the office or in the studio now that I'm not dual channel? And I looked it up and thought, well, thank goodness. Nope, I'm good. So, you know, we'll take it from there.
Oh, hi, band.
It's time. Those guys are going to get sick of playing that song one of these years, you know.
No. Hey, they get the royalties, man.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
There we go. So, Dave, oh, gosh, we didn't even mention this, but if you want to get in touch with us, how would you go about doing so?
I would pick up the phone, and I would call 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. Another way you could get in touch with us is to send us an email with an audio attachment, or just, you know, type something up. And you can send us an email at feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
I'm pretty sure I heard you, but just in case, it's feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
That's absolutely correct. You can Skype us at MacGeekGab?
Yeah, that's right. MacGeekGab.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
That's right. Awesome. All right. We'll take it from there. I guess that's it. We'll bail out while the sound is still working. I have some ideas as to what to try. It's increasing more buffers in different ways, but man, it's getting crazy.
Yeah. You know what I'm going to do, Dave? I am being the heck of a guy that I am. I'm going to give you 100% refund on the cost of that advice.
Are you going to give me 100% refund on what the advice cost me? In terms of time? Headache?
No. And I would say the bad news in this case is that, Dave, you did get caught.
Maynard.